our problem, if we see that, say, the American government has all kinds of problems and it's oppressing people and it's all messed up or something, the main problem isn't necessarily evil people in high places. The problem is that the people in high places have not made a moral decision. They haven't decided, well, I'm going to oppress this person, or I'm going to, say, a corporation head, I'm going to create bad working conditions for these field workers. It's more that that person in a high place has made no moral decision at all. That person hasn't said, I'm going to do something bad, but neither has that person said, I'm going to do something good. The person has just totally ignored a moral choice. They've given up their capacity to be moral. So in a way, that fits in with our understanding of amoral. They're deprived of the capacity to discern between morality and immorality. They just don't see any difference. They don't bother to do anything with it.
And it also has a more active sense. To be demoralized, something has happened to you. Amoral is a description of a person, but demoral is more active. It's something that has been done to us instead of just a state without any. So if the principalities and powers or the demonic or...
Yeah, it's something that has happened to us by something that the principalities and powers have done to us. I'll get into that more later on how they do it to us in their overall process of dehumanization. He says that the chief defining characteristic of a human is the capacity to be moral. That's what separates humans from other animals, is that we can be moral. So that when you take away someone's capacity to make moral decisions and to act morally, you've dehumanized them. That's the main thing that death does in our world through the principalities and powers. I'll get into that a little more later. He works on the general framework off of the book of Revelation, the last book in the Bible. So he uses the imagery from there, mainly the imagery of Babylon versus Jerusalem. Babylon being the area where death reigns, where Satan reigns. Jerusalem is where Christ reigns. He uses that imagery all through the book, taking, say, an obvious example of Nazi Germany being a really obvious example of Babylon. But he doesn't say then that America is the example of Jerusalem. That's one of the main things he's cutting down in this book, is that a lot of people identify America with Jerusalem, or America is the kingdom of God would be another term for it. That this is where God has her will in our world, is in America, and so everything America does is good and all that kind of stuff. So he's contrasting Babylon on one side, Jerusalem on the other side, and he's trying to show which is Babylon, which is Jerusalem, which one is which. And finally, the conclusion of the book is saying that that's our task, is to discern Babylon, to see in our society in specific instances what is Babylon, and to see what is Jerusalem, and to not get the two confused. The first thing we have to do in being human is to discern where the power of death is in our lives and where the power of Christ is. The incarnation as the sanctification of the world. He spends a lot of time in the first part of the book talking about incarnation of Jesus Christ in our world, saying that the difference between Christianity and all other religions and ideologies is that Christianity is based very completely in time. All other religions have some sort of a base out of time. They're maybe moving toward a utopia in another Never Never Land, or they're trying to escape the confines of the body, or trying to somehow get out of our bodily, worldly, time, in time existence. And Christianity is very completely immersed in time. So there again, he's trying to cut down very pervasive American thought systems, which try to make Christianity something that doesn't really apply to our world. He wants us to see Christianity as something that very completely ties into this world in this time, that it's not just something in the afterlife. It's not just something that happens way up there somewhere. Principalities and powers aren't crazy things in pre-creation time between God and wild angel-type creatures. Principalities and powers are very concrete things right here. Dole is a principality. Holden Village is a principality. The United States is a principality. Very concrete things in our world. And so Babylon is very concrete in our world. Jerusalem is very concrete. Jerusalem isn't an afterlife that we go to after we die. Jerusalem is something that actually happens. It's an event that happens with people and with real things, things that we can see and touch. And that has big implications on our ethics if the Bible is talking so completely about end time. Then, chapter 3, the moral reality named death. Once he gets to that point, he starts talking about death, 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 death. Gets to you after a while. Death is incarnate and embodied all over our world. Death is the chief moral reality of our time. I think he even says death is the only moral reality, the only moral power in our time. Let me read you his definition of death, which is also pretty inclusive. In this book, when the name of death is used, I intend it to bear every definition and nuance, every association and suggestion, every implication and intuition that anyone has ever attributed to death. And I intend that the name of death here bear all meanings simultaneously and cumulatively. Which includes just about everything.
At the beginning of the book, if it lists his other books, is Second Birthday listed or not? Or do you know when this came? He did have a battle with a disease. And his Second Birthday already published?
Yes.
Yeah. Was published. I saw him later. I don't know what he weighs now. I saw him once, and he gave a speech, and he weighed 94 pounds and walked with a cane and sat for the speech. And it was a kind of miraculous recovery from a very strange kind of leukemia-type cancer of the blood in that. But all of the study of Revelation and Babylon and death, a lot of them has taken on a new role in his writings. Although the Easter sermons, instead of death, were written very early, just thrilled as far as the victory of Easter. So he's always been on the theme. But
yeah, he ends up with a victory.
Yeah.
But he wants to make sure that we realize that the victory is in the context of death. And then that is the reality in our world. Death includes everything. He says death is the social purpose in our time. What he means by that is that our society is run by things which have no other purpose than death. And he takes the chief example, he calls it a grotesque example, of war. This is written in 73, so he uses the Vietnam War as the chief example in a lot of things, saying that there is no other reason to have the Vietnam War than death. That is the only reason to participate in it for it to be there at all. I think we can apply the same thing to nuclear weapons in our day. There's really no other reason that nuclear weapons should be made other than death. That's the only real purpose for them. Everything else just falls apart. The fall. He also talks a lot about the fall, and he calls everyone in the world naive who thinks that only humans are fallen. He's saying, when the world, after the creation is fallen, and that means all of creation, not just people. People are sinful. We're all used to thinking about that. But he says, biblically, everything is fallen. This includes people, it includes cattle and bunny rabbits, and it also includes principalities and powers. That means that the United States government, since it's a principality, is fallen. It's controlled by the power of death. That means Holden Village is, as a principality, is fallen. It's part of the fallen world, and we shouldn't expect the principalities like the government to be good things that can be manipulated by humans to do wonderful things when they're part of a fallen world. Yeah.
What happened to the notion of the dead?
That comes at the very end.
What's the difference between fallen and broken, or fallen and consciously oriented toward producing death rather than an institution that at least constitutes itself toward life-giving activities?
Does he separate out
fallenness or?
A biblical description of the fall concerns the alienation of the whole creation from God.
Yeah, that's very
cool. I found a real contradiction that I really couldn't reconcile, in that he also talks about the church setting up an ecclesiastical bureaucracy on the Jerusalem side in opposition to the fallen bureaucracies. And I couldn't figure out how he reconciled that. At one point he says all bureaucracies are fallen. At another point he says we need to set up a good bureaucracy. And I wasn't sure how that happens.
Yeah. So, in terms of Orthodox theology, he's really missing the boat if he doesn't deal with the issue of redemption. And that phrase, either new is the creature or, the way Yoder points it out, new is creation. And if you take it as Yoder says, new is creation, that means institutions are new too. That doesn't mean they don't have problems, but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily demonic. So it's, I don't know, it's just, so far, that's one of my faults.
Yeah, let's see if we can.
But, you know, it's okay.
He says that all principalities are doomed to die, that they won't have the final victory. That kind of life. He goes in, I'll get in that in just a second too, and that he talks about the traits of the principalities. This is the two questions he's dealing with are, who or what are the principalities and powers, and how are the principalities related to the moral reality of death? In order to do that, he lists about 10 traits of the principalities. So let's review real quick what the principalities are, so we know what we're describing. All authorities, corporations, institutions, traditions, processes, structures, bureaucracies, ideologies, systems, sciences, and the like. Okay. Those are what we're talking about. The first trait of them, of course, is that they are legion. That means there's just lots of them. They're all over, and they're in all sizes and shapes and all names. Oh, here's another list. Institutions, ideologies, all images, all movements, all causes, all corporations, all bureaucracies, traditions, methods and routines, conglomerates, races, nations, and idols. Then he lists Pentagon, Ford Motor Company, Harvard University, Hudson Institute, or Consolidated Edison, or the Diners Club, or the Olympics, or the Methodist Church, or the Teamsters Union.
That's
right. Oh, no. He gets Mormonism after a while. Capitalism, Maoism, humanism, Mormonism, astrology, the Puritan worth ethic, science and scientism, white supremacy, patriotism, sports, sex, any profession or discipline, technology, money, the family. He goes into all of it. Okay, so they're all over the place, all different kinds, all different names. Now, the second trait that he ascribes to them is probably the most important, because most of his analysis comes out of it, and that is that the principalities are creatures. They have a life. A principality has a life of its own. It has its own existence, its own personality, its own mode of life. That means it exists apart from anybody else. A principality is there, and it's autonomous from people. You can have a bureaucracy, and you can have a bunch of bureaucrats who make up the bureaucracy, but the bureaucracy as a principality is more than the sum of all its bureaucrats. And it can do things that all the bureaucrats don't want it to. Everyone in, say, IBM, I don't know, everyone who makes up the vast system of IBM could want IBM to do something a certain way. But IBM could still do it a different way, because IBM is an entity all in itself. Apart from the people who made it. Even though the Constitution of the United States was drafted and written and conceived and voted on by people, the Constitution of the United States now has power far beyond those people. It does things that those people never intended it to do. Those people are all dead. The Constitution is still there. It exists apart from the people who made it, and it exists apart from the people who it now acts upon. It's something all to itself. It's autonomous. and it's fallen. That's where, again, he says, all institutions exist in a moral state which is the equivalent of death. So that since everything, since the context of creation is death, if that institution is in that context, then that institution is in death.
That really isn't true.
And he's saying that, again, your example of IBM, I mean, that's then saying that IBM becomes part of the supernatural power. I mean, it's a live organism to itself, and I don't think that that's true.
I agree.
You don't think it's a live organism?
Well, I mean, I don't think it exists apart from the people that comprise it. I think this is, I muttered something that my brother John agreed, it sounds very much like Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man and Immoral Society. His whole thesis is human beings, John and I, can be moral to each other, but for some reason, when we get together at a board meeting at the Holden Board, or as members of a state legislature, we seem to be able to do things or to justify things that we would never do ourselves, but because of our relationship to a large organization, we do immoral things that we'd never do if we were just doing them personally.
But not the organization is doing, it's the people acting together and justifying evil things.
It's a unique dynamic to that.
Niebuhr says it in a way that you would understand, because he says it kind of like a sociologist or an examiner of human dynamics. Stringfellow, you'll never understand Stringfellow unless you understand that he purposefully, he could write the other way, he's a lawyer, trained lawyer, he purposefully writes theologically. He gives theological images, almost apocalyptic or poetic images, to make very strong cases, so he consciously does not psychologize or get into sociology or group dynamics. He's always in images that kind of startle. And so it's really kind of hard for us to listen to a summary without sensing the style of the book. I mean, you're doing a good job, but it's hard to move into Stringfellow without reading it and getting kind of immersed in it. I don't know if anybody else who writes like certain passages of the Book of Revelation. I mean, it wouldn't be the point to ask, is that literally true that IBM has a life of its own separate from the people? I mean, that's a scientific question coming to a theological truth. Does that? I'm not sure that's adequate, but I think it's beginning to understand Stringfellow
a little bit. Since principalities have lives of their own,
according to William Stringfellow, yes. Go ahead.
Since they are autonomous from well, let me read this sentence straight from him. Pretending autonomy from God, these creatures are autonomous from human control. In reality, they dominate human beings. We pretty much run on the idea that we dominate the institutions that we've created. That for instance, that the people of the United States control the United States government. That's what democracy is all about. Whereas in reality, the United States government controls us. That even happens on the highest levels, in that we kind of think that President Reagan or the Congress people or the senators, that they control the American government. But in reality, the American government, as an institution, as a principality, all on its own, controls them and directs them more than they control it. Once Reagan has proposed the Reagan Strategic Program for nuclear weapons, that program is going to dictate the way that Reagan has to deal with nuclear weapons. And Reagan may have some control over it, but it has more control over him than he has over it.
Another author that's making the same point, he's not any easier to read, Jacques Ellul, The Technological Society, is saying a very similar thing. Let me give you one story that I remember that says it maybe in a much more homey way than either of these two scholarly people. I had a Jesuit priest friend, and he had a brother who was one of three or four priests in the Philippine Islands way back, And they made it a diocese. The Roman Catholic Church made the Philippine Islands a diocese. So one of those four had to be the bishop. And they said, oh, McSorley, he'll make a good bishop. So all of a sudden, this priest was a bishop. And Dick said, now when he comes, you can't disagree with him, and the kids can't sit on his lap. And he said, that little red vest robbed me of a brother. And he went on to say, it's the office that's the violence. We put good people in those offices, like being a bishop of a church. And it's the office that's the violence. In other words, he was saying, it's no longer my brother, partly because now, can an office have a life of its own? Well, I think Dick was pointing to the same, a similar thing to what Elul and Stringfellow were talking about.
He lists a number of contemporary examples of how an institution or a corporation or a bureaucracy autonomously victimizes people, exercises dominion over them. This dehumanization is one term of current jargon for the reversal of dominion between persons and principalities. Reversal of dominion. Usually we think people have dominion over principalities, whereas in reality principalities have dominion over people. Specific illustrations of it from contemporary American experience abound. In the precedence, for example, of bureaucratic routine over human need in the administration or welfare of Medicaid. In the brutalization of inmates, where imprisonment is really a means of banishing people from human status, hiding them, treating them as animals or as if they were dead as human beings. In the separation of citizens in apartheid, enforced, as the case may be, by urban housing and development schemes, by racial limitations of access to credit or by the militia. In the social priorities determined by the momentum of technological proliferation, regardless of either environmental or human interest, thereby neglected, damaged, or lost. In genocide practiced for generations against Indian Americans, in the customs of male chauvinism, in the fraud and fakery and the perils of human health and safety sponsored by American merchandising methodology. Sexism might be something we could take that we've been dealing with here in the village, in that even though we may not have a bunch of men consciously, specifically geared toward oppressing all the women in the village, and even though also all the women in the village let's say all the men in the village don't want to oppress the women, and even though all the women in the village want to be full human beings, sexism is still going to operate in that situation, and there's still going to be some bad stuff going on because of it, even though the individual human beings aren't interested in that happening. That, in that way, sexism is a principality. An example, how about a real, fairly innocuous, though not completely innocuous.
I have an example.
Okay, go ahead.
Something that actually happened was there was sort of an emergency. There were a couple avalanches on the road, and they had to be, the road had to be opened up right away. And there were lots of little tiny things that happened that showed that women were not to be the ones responsible and vital to digging out the road. It was the men who went down first, and the men who drove the cats, the snow cats, and the, you know, that sort of thing. And a lot of little side comments that from lots of different people, and these people were under pressure and they were working hard. And they cared about all of us. We all cared about each other. But from the way they were brought up and our culture, they've learned to think certain ways. And when they're under pressure, they don't think about what they're saying as much, maybe, and then it comes out.
Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
It goes on in describing the traits of the principalities with the question, are some powers benign? Or are some of the powers gracious or of a kindly disposition? Are some of the powers okay? And he says, I had to look up benign, so I thought I'd define it in case anybody else didn't know what it means. He says, people keep insisting, like we are here, that there are some of these principalities that with sufficient human will and energy we can turn to good ends. some of these principalities are going to be okay. We can use them for good purposes. Now, listen to this. I suggest this to be, however, a virtually incredible view. It is both, be ready, because he's talking exactly to what we've been saying. Just thought I'd put a little emotional impact in here. It is both too naive and too narrow, incorrigible, and a stance which is both theologically false and empirically unwarranted. It really asserts that the principalities are only somewhat or sometimes fallen, and that the fall is not an essential condition of disorientation, morally equivalent to the state of death, affecting the whole of creation in time. It is, moreover, a remarkable expression of human vanity, insisting that human dominion over the rest of creation, if occasionally ineffectual, is nonetheless retained if humans have the stamina to exercise it. Okay.
He's just wrong theologically.
Well, that's the same thing he said about you, theologically false.
Well, I know, but I mean, really, I'm not. If there is supposed to be a dynamic between the relationship of redemption and sin, if you always collapse that dynamic into sin, you haven't got a dynamic.
Okay. Well,
so in other words, if you're saying yes that things are fallen and that indeed Jesus Christ came and died and the world was quote redeemed in Jesus Christ, but the world is still fallen, then Jesus Christ didn't redeem the world. So I don't see what the I mean, there's a certain. I'm picking up on stuff that I think Yoder makes a strong and an important point on, and that is that phrase: "Not new is the creature, but new is creation." Not only is the creature new in Christ, not only are our human potential and ethics new in Christ, but so is human life, life in general, new in Christ. That the world is redeemed. And that's a real radical thing that I'm not willing to give up. I'm not naive. I'm not stupid. That doesn't mean I think that American covert sabotage missions in Nicaragua are beautiful or redeemed. But at the same time, I'm not willing to throw out human beings, human institutions. And I can't make that jump from human creatures to human institutions and separate the two, because human creatures make up human institutions.
Yeah, well, human beings are fallen. I'm fallen, and I'm also redeemed. So even though I'm redeemed, I'm still sinful, and I'm still under the influence of the power of death.
And you are capable of forgiving.
Yeah, but
forgiving.
You still have to ask forgiveness and be forgiving daily, or there's no sense in confession. If everything is redeemed, then you're...
No, that's
I mean,
true.
There's a tension.
But
there.
At least, yeah, but once you are forgiven, there is a potential. In other words,
he doesn't say there's no potential for does he?
Well, there does in the one place where he talks about the church setting up a principality, or he doesn't say principality, an ecclesiastical bureaucracy in tension with the Babylon ones. In that way, we would see the principalities as being redeemable.
How is death? Also, another question I have is he trying, when he uses the term principalities and powers, that's right out of Paul, is he trying to say that his definition of principality and powers is consonant with Paul's?
Oh, yeah. Very much so. And the archetypical principality is the state.
Yeah.
What does Paul mean in Romans 8 when he says that the whole creation waits for the revealing of the sons of God, waits for redemption? Groans and waits. Is that real office?
No, that's really on it, I think. If the whole creation is waiting for redemption, then they're not redeemed yet. Then they're still fallen, and they're in a fallen state.
In Romans 8, when Paul says the whole creation waits, groaning, waits for the redemption, not the creation only, but we too. By God who subjected it to futility, that whole section on waiting for our redemption.
There is no question, biblically or theologically, that the creation was good. The orderings of God and that the creation, all of the creation, is fallen or broken. There's no doubt about that. The point is, what is the redemption of Christ? And at what point do fallen creations, principalities, powers, orders, governments, institutions, what have you, at what point are they again ordered by God and for our good? Can any of them, all of which are fallen, biblically, now be what they're supposed to be through the work of the Holy Spirit, through sanctification, through being a redeemed creature? And at this point, Stringfellow is not giving much of a glimpse of hope of that, obviously. Mm-hmm. And it's either, and it's been a long time since I read it, it's either that as a lawyer he continues the polemic far beyond what anybody else would in order to get to the last chapter. He is afraid that we're going to call this particular nation or one of our institutions Jerusalem and have an idol. And he argues like nobody you've ever seen before in saying things that other people would say much more gently or much more mildly. So I think you got to wait till the last chapter kind of thing if it's a typical Stringfellow book. But he argues just hard. I mean, just to get you upset.
Yeah, that helps in seeing what he's arguing against. The main thing he's arguing against is that America is Jerusalem. America is the kingdom of God where everything is hunky-dory.
Everyone will have had to say of the country they lived in, whenever they lived in it, it was Babylon. That's Stringfellow's point. The trouble is when sometime, at some point, some group says, now this is Jerusalem. It just isn't true. So it's not a particular indictment against the United States of America. It's a theological position. And he thinks we're tending toward thinking, now this is Jerusalem. And when that's so, you'll never understand the gospel. Isn't that pretty much where he comes
into it? Could you say, too, that even Babylon, I mean the real Babylon, while it was an evil power, it did a certain amount of ordering of human life that made human life a little more possible than if you would have had complete anarchy. Would there be some of that? But
yeah, so there are little...
Babylon,
so there are little tinges and spontaneous sparks of Jerusalem every once in a while in Babylon. We have to recognize that's happening in the context of a Babylon. Is that tying into what you said?
Yeah, I had somebody explained it to me from the standpoint of the church in Nicaragua, where they were, the church was totally on the side of the revolution. Then after the revolution, when the new regime started, by necessity or whatever, we're not sure, started taking away some human rights, and then the church started becoming a fairly critic even of the new regime, a friendly critic. And it was a way the church in Nicaragua affirmed that Jerusalem had not come.
Okay, I'll move on from there. It's about 7:15, so we don't have a whole lot of time left. The ninth trait of the powers of the principalities, I haven't been going through them real orderly, in a very orderly fashion. But anyway, it's the rivalry among the powers. All these powers are competing with each other, and the prime purpose of each power is to survive. And to try to perpetuate itself. Any nation will try to perpetuate itself. Any corporation will try to perpetuate itself. And in order to do this, it often clashes with other principalities. So we've got the United States clashing with Nazi Germany, or we've got two grocery stores clashing with each other in a small town. And they're trying to survive, and in doing so, they clash together. He takes specifically the example of America and Nazi Germany in World War II, and that clash, each one trying to survive. And he says, at the end of the war, the winner is not Nazi Germany, and the winner is not America either. The winner is death, or war. The winner of World War II is World War II. Or he puts it, the demonic power of the Axis powers won the war. So when principalities clash, They're fighting against each other, but at the same time, they're coming together and collaborating against human beings and against humanization and life. They're collaborating for the power of death, even though they're fighting against each other. That's what happens when the principalities fight against each other. And furthermore, he says this all happens in the milieu of chaos. Everything is in this huge, hectic frenzy, so that it's very hard to discern what's going on. It all happens at the same time, and you've got powers fighting each other, and they're all trying to survive, but they're all doomed to death, and they're using all kinds of crazy tactics, and about the only thing we find coming out of it is that we're dehumanized. So then he goes into a whole chapter of stratagems of the demonic powers, which are all, well, not all of them, but a partial listing of tricky devices that the principalities use to get us. Or as the principalities are vassals of death, death uses the principalities, and these are what this is how the principalities go at us to dehumanize us. A lot of it is very Orwellian, just like 1984. He even uses some of the same terms, like doublespeak. One of the stratagems of principalities is doublespeak. War is peace. There are a lot of people here who weren't here a few weeks ago when we did a presentation of the Reagan strategic program. And all through that was just very overt, classic doublespeak. The classic doublespeak is war is peace, mm-hmm. from 1984. And it comes so close to that, just in saying arms build up is arms reduction. Mm-hmm. Just it says it that clearly. And that's one of the stratagems that the principalities use to gain control over us and to dehumanize us and to eliminate our capacity to make moral decisions. Remember that to take away our capacity to make moral decisions is to dehumanize us, and that is to control us with the power of death. Yeah?
Jocko Newell's technical book was Technological Society. The theological book, which was a companion, which is what he always does. He always writes one as a sociologist and then one as a lay theologian. The comparable book to Technological Society was called Propaganda. So it's this identical kind of linkage. I don't know if Stringfellow lists him as a bibliography source, but he certainly must have read a lot of L.U.
Yeah.
How do human beings make moral decisions if, since they're part and parcel of tradition, a government, a church, all these human institutions, a family, their sex lives, how are they capable of making a moral decision if they are part and parcel of these institutions, these principalities, which are demoralizing them? How are they even capable of being moral?
But through the power of God, and through the gifts of the Spirit.
Okay. It's the gifts. Is that the last chapter?
That's the second to last chapter. The gifts of discernment, of healing, glossolalia, of exorcism.
What's glossolalia?
Speaking in tongues. I'll whip fairly quickly through the strategy.
Okay, in case you don't get to it, William Stringfellow is the only one I know who makes glossolalia a political act. In a land where everything is double talk, propaganda, and the negative, the only legitimate response theologically is to babble back in tongues.
Yeah, he says glossolalia is a parody of Babel.
Sure. That's Stringfellow, just through and through.
Become a victim of his own theories, I guess.
That was good.
You want to say a little more about that?
That's quite clear.
Just a word of wisdom, I guess.
Stratagems of the demonic powers, the denial of truth. This isn't so much telling lies overtly as claiming that truth is non-existent. There is no real truth. It's just a matter of how you look at it. And that's in 1984, that's the Ministry of Truth, which is all about cutting out all the old newspaper articles that say something you don't want them to say and replacing them with new newspaper articles. The denial that there is any truth or ever was any truth. It's just saying truth is whatever we want it to be right now. That's one of the stratagems. Another stratagem is secrecy and boasts of expertise. You see this all the time in the administration.
You knew what we knew.
Yes. Exactly. It's really clear. Surveillance and harassment. The elimination of privacy. This is another stratagem that the demonic powers use to control us. Cursing and conjuring. This is an interesting one. And he means curse quite literally as a condemnation to death, as damnation. The demonic powers curse the human beings who resist them. Mm-hmm. Take a look again at the Reagan strategic program as a principality. It curses the Soviet Union and condemns them very literally to death. If they are opposed to the United States, then they're going to die. Usurpation and absorption, which as far as I could tell was the Herodian option, or kind of co-opting people into it so that, you know, we'll kind of snuggle up to you and treat you nice, and then you'll become part of us, and then all of a sudden you don't stand in opposition to us anymore. Diversion and demoralization. This is an interesting one in that the example he uses is American sports, saying that the Monday Night Football is a principality, and it's also used by other principalities, such as the nation, to divert our attention from political affairs, so that instead of thinking about politics, we're watching Monday Night Football. That's a diversion. And it takes away our moral decision-making capacities, so that instead of making decisions, we're watching TV and we're watching the sports games. And so that when we come to a political trial of the Black Panthers or of whoever, it's no longer a moral activity for us as we're reading about it and thinking about it. Instead, it's a sporting event. So that the powers divert our attention and get us to think in just irrelevant ways.
Games of competition, keep thinking it.
Yeah, competition would be a principality.
See, I tend to deny that myself. But I read in the history books that that's exactly what the Roman Empire mm-hmm. did, and they created gladiators and circuses. Mm-hmm.
He makes that direct comparison.
But when somebody tells me that, then I tend to deny that. But he doesn't give as much historical kind of stuff that I could go along with, because it's way back there. He's always...
I was questioning back in the Roman times, it was the government that did that. Now, in our society, it isn't the government that sets up Monday Night Football.
No, it's not the government, but it's collaborating principalities like CBS or NBC.
So they just can't have fun.
Huh?
Right. I really agree with this guy. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
And.
Yeah.
I mean, it works just on individual relationships.
Yeah, now look, the people in ABC are not interested in diverting, in making the American people demoralized.
Right.
They're not interested in keeping us from making political decisions. But ABC is doing that.
That's the net result.
That's what happens.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though ABC doesn't want it, and even though maybe the people in power in the government don't want it, the two principalities of ABC and the American government are collaborating with each other.
They don't know.
The question
but they
would
are.
Be, because I agree, I don't
people
think,
don't
I'm not paranoid in thinking that someone told ABC to do that because that would divert me from
no.
an issue. The question would be whether anybody sat down consciously in the Roman Empire
mm-hmm.
and planned that, or whether that seemed just as kind of either accidental or innocuous as it does to us. And I
couldn't argue that it could be demonic powers, or it is demonic powers that is working on a master plan of Monday Night Football.
Yeah, right.
Or
TV in general, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, the only thing I guess I have problems with that is that it makes, I guess this is what he's saying, everything is evil. Then I guess the only thing left is, and this is maybe what he's saying too, is death.
Yeah. Well, let me get on to the last two chapters quick in 5 minutes. Okay, he finishes up that whole section saying that Babel is inherently violent. The state is the preeminent principality, and the state, we can see all these all the other principalities kind of subsumed in the, all the traits of the principalities subsumed in the state, and then he subsumed, is that a word?
Subsumed?
I shouldn't have used it, I don't know what it means.
Subsumed?
That's not a word?
Subsumed?
Could he admit that his book is also part of the demonic?
Probably.
Yeah?
Probably.
A system of theology.
He's creating a depression, and that's the all.
No, because he finishes up with happy chapters.
Oh, good.
Okay. So he finishes that much of the book by saying the state is the Antichrist. Okay. And then he has this much left to say what to do about it. The main thing we have to do about it is confront it. We have to confront the powers and name them, identify them. Let me read I have a paragraph with lots of stars around it. The biblical response, again, an answer which also has empirical authority. The biblical response is that hope is known only in the midst of coping with death. Any so-called hope is delusory and false without or apart from the confrontation with the power of death, whatever momentary or circumstantial form that may have. It is a person's involvement in that crisis in itself, which is the definitively humanizing experience. Engagement in specific and incessant struggle against death's rule renders us human. Resistance to death is the only way to live humanly in the midst of the fall. Since everything is fallen, the way to live humanly is to resist that fallenness. And that's where he comes up with the gift of discernment, which is the key to being a Christian or an alien in a strange land, is to discern in the American government, for instance, Babylon, to discern that when the government builds a Trident submarine, that that is the power of death working. To discern that when a multinational corporation oppresses people in a third world country, that that is the power of death working. And also to discern when the local grocery store throws out food that could have been given to somebody who needed it. That is the power of death working. To discern it in personal relationships, but mainly to discern it in these principalities, that there is death at work in these principalities, and we have to be able to identify that. And on the flip side, we have to be able to discern Jerusalem, where it happens. Jerusalem happens in very short, spontaneous little sparks, here, there, now, then, and we have to be able to say, hey, that was Jerusalem when that happened. That was something good. That was the power of life. In that moment, the victory of Jesus Christ was realized in human history. That's where the discernment comes in, and that's where the real fulfillment of human life happens, when we discern evil and where we confront it.
Even your example, though, about, again, the multinational corporation, then I would assume that what you're saying, maybe not, but then the local people, working to build up their own economy is Jerusalem, even if they put down some other local people.
No, then that's not true. Then we have to be able to look at it and say, that's not Jerusalem.
I just objected to your example because, the multinational corporation becomes the evil, but what's the opposite of that?
Okay, well, we'll also say that we have to be able to discern evil when the local people rise up and shoot the president of the multinational corporation, and we have to say that that's demonic too.
Yeah, but it doesn't even have to go that far. It's when the local people, get ahead at the expense of their neighbor.
Yeah, okay, then we have to be able to discern that also as Babylon.
See,
I was just trying to use huge examples.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I guess what I object to is that we always use, those examples, and so we tend to forget about the things that we are doing. Most of us aren't belonging to a multinational corporation,
Mm-hmm.
But we are hurting our neighbor because of, things we might do or not do.
Which is to say death is inherent in our situation.
Uh-huh. Sounds familiar.
Whether it's the local hardware store who has competition from another or has been able to exclude the competition.
Yeah, and the demonic power in our local level becomes that we fail to see that and only look to, the national government, the multinational corporation, on and on and on, and that's where our effort goes instead of solving, the neighborly problems at home.
Yeah.
The time we have to move on more to hope.
Hope. Okay. The hope is primarily in the charismatic gifts, or the gifts of the Spirit. The first one, which from which the others come, is discernment. And then he talks very specifically about speaking in tongues, healing, and exorcism. And that, like we talked a little bit before, speaking in tongues is kind of a spontaneous response that parodies the babble that the powers give us. Healing is a very overt way of denying, of overruling the power of death. Healing someone who is sick is the power of life overcoming the power of death. And in whatever form it may take, whether it's some dramatic thing happening, if someone is lying here and I go, like that, or whether it's medical. But when it's the Spirit healing, then that is, when it's Spirit healing in the context of the church, that is life overcoming death. And then exorcism, in drawing the demonic out of a principality, is a way that we can conquer the death. And that's when he ties in liturgy and worship, saying that worship and liturgy are a very important part of the Jerusalem and of how we are to act in America today in exercising, in getting through worship and various exorcism exercises, getting the demonic out of the principalities.
How do we do
the Lord's Prayer? He says it's exorcism. I have negative 1 minute, so I'm going to read the last little bit here, which shows that he does end up with a happy sentence. Is there no promise for America? Is there no American future different from the present or from the past? Is there no American dream except nightmare? If America is Babylon and Babylon is not Jerusalem, confounding what all along so many Americans have been told or taught and have believed, is there any American hope? The categorical answer is no. The answer informed by the biblical witness is no. The answer for those who are Christians is no. And therefore, the answer which Christians commend to other human beings is no. The courage to say no in this sense, the audacity of human beings who are Americans in the present national circumstances to utter that no is paradoxically the signal of lively hope. Okay? It's in saying no to the powers, that is the signal of hope, a hope transcending America's bondage to death. It is a hope wrought in realism about this nation and identifying what's actually going on in the nation. A hope which confronts the fallenness of the American principality, a hope which confesses the nation's death idolatry, a hope emancipated from moral naivete about any supposed unique destiny for the nation, a hope freed from vainglorious delusions that America is a holy nation. The courage to say no in this sense is in itself a radically humanizing experience. It is a no which verifies a waking conscience. In saying no, we exercise our moral capacity. In saying no, we are humanized. This no is the no of resistance to the power of death, where, as those who resisted the Nazi totalitarianism have shown, resistance is the only way to live humanly. So our hope is in resisting. From this no issues the only hope worthy of human beings, because no to death, incarnate in the nation or in any other appearance, means yes to the gift of life. So, final two sentences, two paragraphs, which are happy. So, from death arises new life. Suffering issues in celebration. To be ethical is to live sacramentally. To discern apocalyptic signs heightens the expectation of the eschatological events. In resistance, persons live most humanly. No to death means yes to life. During the Babylonian captivity, the psalmist cries out, "How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land?" The answer is heard in the jubilation of the heavenly chorus at the doom of Babylon. Time for Vespers.